and wondering how to help. We ask that you consider performing an act of kindness or volunteering with a charitable organization in your own local community. We hope that some small measure of good may be returned to the world.
And you were just listening to Democracy Now! Up next is KBOO Evening News, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kboo.fm. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, dedicated to helping adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including the Green MBA in Sustainable Business and the MBA in Healthcare Management. Evening, weekend, and online classes allow students to keep days free for work and other commitments. Enrolling now for winter and spring terms.
KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On December 10th, the film My So-Called Enemy is about two Palestinian and Israeli teenage girls who get to know their enemies as human beings while participating in a leadership program in the United States. That is December 10th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protesters nationwide demand the release of an indigenous leader of a Mexican community. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protesters nationwide demand the release of an indigenous leader of a Mexican community.
The federal government implements a new rule separating Wall Street gambling.
8 tech giants call for reform to surveillance law. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 10th, 2013. I'm Sam Smith.
And I'm Nat Parker. Protests were held in front of several Mexican consulates in the U.S. today in support of Mexican-American woman by the name of Nestora Salgado Garcia, who has been in Mexican federal custody since August 27th. Garcia was reported to have angered the local officials of Guerrero Province, who charged her with kidnapping and gave her the maximum sentence in prison. Her supporters say that she was targeted as a leader of the indigenous community of Olinala. Many states have joined in on the protests to release Nestora in representation of Human Rights Day. Portland protesters were at the local downtown Mexican consulate to demonstrate for Nestora's release. KBOO's Sequoia Wright was there and brings us the sounds of the protest.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, let Nestora Salgado go.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, let Nestora Salgado go.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, let Nestora Salgado go.
Hey, go, hey, hey,
ho, ho,
let Nestora Salgado go.
Hey, hey,
ho, ho,
let Nestora Salgado go.
I'm Chaz with the Freedom Socialist Party, and I'm out here today to support Nestora Salgado, who is an indigenous rights fighter for the last 4 years, has gone down into southern Mexico to Olinala to provide blankets, food and supplies, and started leading, she coordinated community policing to protect people from corruption, to protect people from violence and domestic abuse, And for that, she angered local officials, and they put her in prison in Mexico.
On false charges.
Yeah, on false charges, trumped up charges of kidnapping. We're here to support her and demand her freedom.
That's right. And there's actually about 14 other political prisoners who are also indigenous and community police organizers who are also have also been in prison. So we're also demanding their release. This is also part of an international day of protest in honor of International Human Rights Day. So there are protests happening across the United States, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, obviously Portland, as well as in Mexico City and in the Dominican Republic. So this case is hopefully striking fear in the heart of the Mexican government, and that will result in her liberation very quickly. She also has medical issues, so we want to make sure that while she is being incarcerated, that she is treated well, that she has full access to medical care, and more importantly, is liberated quickly. I did not fact check this, but I learned today that there was a people's voting procedure of some sort which placed the community policing citizens in the position of protecting their own as opposed to the state-run police systems. And so the people having participated in choosing their own people to protect them, to me, seemed like a very strong compliment to her activism.
When indigenous rights are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back! When immigrant rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When indigenous rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When immigrant rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
The protesters presented signs and letters at the local consulate demanding that the president of Mexico end the military occupation of Nestor's hometown of Olinala. One of the protest organizers spoke with KABU about the action.
Earlier this, during the picket, we did present a letter to the consul here, a letter to the president of Mexico, outlining why there are all these pickets that are happening and our demands to free
Where else are they happening?
They are also happening in Seattle, Los Angeles, at all the Mexican consulates in L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, New York. There's actually one also in Port Angeles on Saturday. And there's one happening in Chicago. And also there are groups in the Dominican Republic at that Mexican consulate, and also actually in Mexico City. They're flyering in Mexico City. So there's an international effort to bring attention to her case, which actually is so multi, it touches so many communities. Women who are fighting domestic abuse, indigenous communities that are fighting for right to self-determination and to fight back against poverty. People who are concerned about the impact of free trade agreements should care about her case, because the poverty that indigenous communities are suffering from is a direct result of free trade agreements that are decimating other countries.
Well, this is Human Rights Day, the, I think, 47th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Mexico is a signatory. They should live up to the promises that they made when they signed the Universal Declaration.
We're also, a lot of attention is paid to Mandela today and in the last few days because he died. Well, one of the chants that we used to say was, well, we honor the dead and fight for the living. And one of the living is Nestora Salgado and her comparos. And that's who we're focusing on.
This is a poem called La Comandanta Nestora. You can also find it on poetry.com. It's by Oso Sabio. An authentic example of opposition to the violent failures of the current system. Her arrest a sign of government fear that the end of their reign is growing near. I know that nothing is worth my life, but in the face of terror, I'd rather die. resisting and fighting than sitting back, not knowing when they're going to attack. 13, married to an abusive man, she soon took her children to another land, enslaved, cooked, cleaned, and served to give her girls what they deserved. Now back in her homeland, Nestora rose to be the leader of a group repelling those who extort, terrorize, trade in drugs, swarming the nation like a plague of bugs. She presents a danger like all who stand, forced to take justice into their own hands. The state is scared, but she is ours. Her spirit of resistance is in our hearts.
Those were the sounds of a protest held today in downtown Portland at the Mexican consulate, calling for the release of a U.S. citizen and Mexican indigenous leader, Nestora Salgado Garcia.
Today marks International Human Rights Day, commemorating the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the UN in 1948. The declaration arose directly from the experience of the Second World War and represents the first global expression of rights to which all human beings are inherently entitled. Immigration rights activists in the U.S. called for a day of action today for comprehensive immigration reform. They say that the current U.S. system of immigration enforcement threatens the basic human rights of both citizens and non-citizens. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Astrid Dominguez for more on this story.
What is the significance of today being International Human Rights Day on behalf of immigrants in the United States?
The U.S. has been in violation of several international human rights obligations, including the International Convention on Civil Rights, Civil and Political Rights, that protects the right to life, the right to freedom from torture, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. And so the ACLU has been working to stop all this. And particularly as our border communities, we've been pretty concerned with the raising or increasing of abuses that have been committed along the southwest border with Mexico. And this seems that, like, it's been a common practice among immigration agents, whether it's people who are coming into the U.S., who are crossing legally, as they call them, or people who have been in the U.S. Living in the U.S. or U.S. citizens. So we've been asking for to DHS, to the Department of Homeland Security, to change their policy, to have more accountability and oversight over their own CBP agencies.
As some in the conservative spectrum in the U.S. would argue that there is no reason to supply people with rights if they are crossing into the country illegally. And what would be your response from the ACLU on that point?
Well, we know the federal government has authority to control our nation's border and regulate immigration. Nevertheless, they have to do it in compliance with national, international legal norms and standards. We have been promoting human rights and human dignity across the U.S., across the entire world. And I think that's something that we need to apply in our own country.
And is there a chance that immigration reform will take place given the current Congress and their apparent inability to pass any bills, let alone a progressive immigration reform bill?
Well, we continue working towards a comprehensive immigration reform. There are a lot of things that need to be changed, and one of the main reasons we're having this problem is because of a broken immigration system that needs to be fixed from, like, the root. So, the ACLU, along with different national organizations, is still working on having an immigration reform that will fix this problem and that will provide equal opportunities to all the people who are already here in this country.
I've been speaking with Astrid Dominguez. She's with the ACLU of Texas. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Despite expensive lobbying since the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act, a fistful of regulatory agencies charged with oversight of the financial services industry approved what's known as the Volcker Rule today. It's a rule designed to keep banks from engaging in risky investments with deposits that are government insured. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with watchdog group Public Citizen about which banks are likely to feel the impact of the rule, though it's not expected to be implemented until the summer of 2015.
I'm talking with Bartlett Naylor. He is a financial policy analyst at Public Citizen's Congress Watch, and we're going to talk about the unanimous passage by the Federal Reserve of the Volcker Rule.
Five agencies, five bank cops, approved the Volcker Rule today, and yes, the Federal Reserve is perhaps the most important that did adopt that.
This rule is said to bar banks from engaging in proprietary trading. What role would you say this practice played in the financial crisis of 2008?
I think it was central, and let's step back and discuss proprietary trading. Understand that when you go to a bank and deposit your paycheck into your checking account, it's not doing that as a philanthropy. You're actually lending the bank money. And since 1933, we have not needed to care if that bank was well managed or even burned to the ground with your paycheck still in the teller window, because the government would pay us back if that bank was mismanaged or it burned down. What that means for the bank is a pretty good deal. They don't actually have to offer very much interest to us for our short-term loan to them. They know that we don't care if they're good managers or not. Now, what we want in exchange, what we, the public, wants in exchange for that government guarantee is for them to do socially useful things, such as make loans to businesses so they can build factories or expand their storefront, or to home buyers to buy a mortgage and fulfill that American dream of home ownership. But it's so much more tempting for a bank to take that quick, easy, cheap money and go off to Las Vegas and gamble, I'm speaking metaphorically, to go off and invest in a speculative stock or something that promises a high return, though by very nature it's going to be risky. We've had an era of deregulation, and that made for some fat times for a while, but then it all exploded, or it was a house of cards that fell down in 2008 when it was revealed that all of this speculation made possible through proprietary trading has a downside. So the Volcker Rule is part of the Wall Street Reform Act, approved in 2010, that said, don't do that. You cannot gamble with that taxpayer-backed institution. Just make socially useful loans.
How many of the, quote, too big to fail, unquote, banks are going to be impacted by this regulation?
There are roughly 7,187 banks in the United States, and I would say 7,182 will be almost completely unaffected. This will affect J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. It will also affect Goldman Sachs, but it's not really a bank. I don't know anybody that has a checking account at Goldman Sachs. Those are really the banks that it will affect. Now, I don't mean to minimize, because those four or five banks control roughly 50% of American deposits. So it's going to affect how they operate in their casino part, but it won't affect them as they face average American consumers.
And how concerned are you about a less than enthusiastic approach to enforcing the new laws once they're in play?
We are Congress Watch. We are Public Citizen. It is our job to highlight when these regulators fall short of their job, to try to communicate to the public that their public officials are not doing their job. So, no, I am not confident that they will do their job without public scrutiny, and that's the role we play. You are home to one of the main heroes in the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule was authored by a junior senator from Oregon named Jeff Merkley, and he was responding to the financial crisis and looking for key methods to repair the damage. He and his staff were reading wisdom from, in this case, the former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. So after a series of meetings, they conceived what became Section 619 of the Wall Street Reform Act. So I would say that Oregonians have to be very proud that a rule that was conceived by their senator has now been made a final rule, and the banks in a few months will have to comply with it. Hooray for Jeff Merkley.
For folks wanting to know more about your organization, what role you play in the rules that affect their lives, can you direct them to a website?
Our website is citizen.org.
This is Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Oregon has some of the priciest gas in the country. That's the results of a recent survey by AAA Oregon, Idaho. The group says while the national average for a gallon of gas fell to $3.18 on November 12th, Oregon's lowest price since February 2011 was $3.27 a gallon, making its gas the 18th most expensive in the U.S. Supplies of gas were plentiful during the Thanksgiving holiday, and retail gas prices in Oregon, as well as the rest of the country, fell after the summer peak. This was in part because of flatter demand and a drop in crude oil prices. In the last few weeks, prices have varied in Oregon. According to the AAA, Oregon is one of the 20 states where prices are lower now than they were in November, while in the other 30 states, prices are slightly higher. Hikes are attributed to unexpected maintenance work at several refineries along the Gulf and stronger demand as well as higher crude oil prices.
A group of child health advocates have launched a campaign to get Fisher-Price to immediately stop selling a child seat with an iPad attached. The campaign for a commercial-free childhood is questioning the safety of the newborn-to-toddler Aptivity seat. It's a bouncy seat for infants with a place for an iPad directly above the baby's face. Because screens can be mesmerizing and because babies are strapped down and restrained, it encourages parents to leave the infants, even newborns, alone in the seat with an iPad. The campaign argues that the very existence of this product suggests that it's fine to leave babies as young as newborn all alone with an iPad inches from their face. But the American Academy of Pediatrics discourages any screen time for children under 2 years old. There's no evidence that babies benefit from screen time, and some evidence that it may be harmful. Research suggests that screen time for children under two is linked to language delays, sleep disturbance, and learning problems later in childhood. Studies also suggest that time with screens takes babies away from activities proven to be beneficial to brain development, hands-on creative play, and positive interaction with caring adults.
The Big Eight social media companies posted a full-page ad in many of the nation's newspapers today. The names are well-known, and their issue cuts to the heart of privacy online for all of us. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
The eight names are ubiquitous in American life. America Online, Apple, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Yahoo. They all ran full-page ads to ask Congress to rein in surveillance gone wild. And they all outlined what they called five basic principles for supporting customer rights. Those are limiting government authority to collect user information, oversight and accountability, transparency about government demands, respecting the free flow of information, and avoiding conflicts with the government. Proposed changes to the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, could, in the opinion of these companies, weaken privacy protections already in place. And that's something that Jeremy Schubert, owner of Portland-based social media company Lunabeam, is concerned about.
Anything that we can do to ensure the privacy of individuals and protect their constitutional rights while making, the surveillance practices themselves, and I think most importantly, as transparent as possible, at least gives us the information to figure out what's going on, what's happening, and to be aware of the practices involved.
Well, I remember when Facebook first became popular, and they went through a change in their privacy policy where, they were saying they were going to make more information public. This was when they were sort of getting their sea legs as to how they should treat, a big audience and a lot of clients. And they really enraged a lot of people, which sort of made people realize that companies, whether or not they're subject to government regulations or not, companies can pretty much do what they want to do with people's personal information. And and so some of the reviews that I've read about this letter, people feel that maybe the companies are being a little disingenuous because they were always profiting and benefiting from people's personal information. But now that the government is using their information for its own business, so to speak, the companies are crying foul. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a line to be drawn between public and private. And on one hand, all of these services, be they Facebook or Twitter, et cetera, are all opt-in services. If you don't want to use them, you don't have to. When you agree to use them, you agree to their privacy policies, and that's just kind of the way things go. But when it comes to the government and unknowingly being spied on or surveyed on, then there has to be some more transparency. That's basically that's why I think it's the line between a public and private, accountability-wise.
This move by the big tech companies is key to getting reform legislation through Congress.
David Fidanke is the executive director of the Oregon ACLU.
So there's a strong need for some of the blank checks that were given to the NSA and other federal surveillance agencies to be reined in and for much stricter oversight going forward. Now, that's not to say that the big tech companies are totally blameless here, but they were as snookered by the NSA as anyone else.
And if that is the case, I pose this question to Mr. Schubert. A lot of these companies already had relationships with the federal government, but they assumed that those relationships were the only relationships. They didn't realize that the government probably had a back door into their data ports and their traffic access points and all this other stuff. And I'm just wondering, as a local company, what has your experience been with, you know, requests for information on particular people, companies? I mean, have you had that experience here with your own company?
No, we haven't. And generally speaking, you know, we're not a Facebook service provider. We're a consulting company that uses a lot of these tools. And so that would be outside of our area, really, to have any sort of government request for our clients' data, and of course we would comply if ever there was, but no, that's really not relevant to what we do.
So then do you, as a owner of a social media company, ever look at some of the things that are going on in the culture with regard to surveillance and data collection, whether governmental or private, you know, private company, and think, you know, maybe there need to be more safeguards on both ends?
Of course. And I think that it's in everybody's best interest, be it Facebook or the government, to make sure that the data is secure. And I think, quite honestly, you know, a company like Facebook and Twitter and all of them go out of their way to make sure that happens. What concerns me is when, the government itself is using techniques that, you know, aren't public and are doing so in our name. And again, like I said, Facebook, Twitter, all these services you can choose not to use, but you can't choose not to be surveyed on.
The question is, are the tech companies lying to us? They've been using our data certainly in intrusive ways, but for the most part, they have not been reselling that information about at least individually identifiable information to third parties. Frankly, I think some of the things that Google does is a little scary, but what the government has been arguing is that because individuals willingly give these companies their information to hold on their behalf, the government has the right to go in through a back door into the servers of these companies and steal that information and use it for intelligence. That is not consistent with current federal law. That is not consistent with our Constitution.
Look out for that. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview by KBOO's Linda Olsen Osterlund with a member of Code Pink for Peace on the recent deportation of two Guantanamo Bay detainees to Algeria after this newscast, followed by Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show at 6. Tonight's show features members of Wild Planet Radio. After that, Dexter Flowers does an interview with Sini, who did a documentary about the lead singer of Bikini Kill. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views of hip-hop. Tonight's Hard Knock Radio remembers Nelson Mandela, with a mixture of classic music and speeches honoring the indigenous leader who fought against South African apartheid. Tomorrow's weather is a high of 36 degrees with areas of freezing fog, the chance of rain, and a low of 27 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are counts per minute in North Portland is high 33, no, is 33 with a high of 60, excuse me. Powell Butte measures 25 CPM with a high of 42. Seaside, Oregon has 33 CPM with a high of 51. And Sitka, Alaska has radiation count of 33 counts per minute, spikes up to 52. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM, and more information can be found at radcast.org.
The time is 5:31. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine! Spy on us, okay. Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent? Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spy master doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The latest group of documents from NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden show that the National Security Agency planted secret agents in online video games. This week's disclosures reveal that the United States has been spying on video gamers around the world. Spies from the U.S. as well as the United Kingdom went undercover and created personas on games like World of Warcraft. The documents claimed that the agents were using the online games to see if alleged terrorists were using the games to try to communicate with each other. The documents released by Snowden do not indicate whether any criminal activity was discovered by this program.
The United States is airlifting African troops to the Central African Republic today as violence continues in that country. French troops were deployed to the CAR last week in an effort to stabilize the country. Two French soldiers were killed overnight by gunmen in the capital city. Crowds attacked a mosque, looted businesses, and burned cars. All of this took place just hours before French President François Hollande was scheduled to arrive for a visit. The violence has been ongoing since Muslim rebels seized power from President François Bozizé in March. Sectarian violence between Muslims and Christians has left over 400 dead.
Today, Native activists in Ontario stage protests against new Canadian legislation, which they say would limit the collective rights of First Nations people. The law is known as the First Nations Education Act. It affects the ways in which federal bureaucracy in Canada can administrate First Nations. KBOO reporter Sam Smith interviewed Russell Dibo, founder of the Ottawa-based group Defenders of the Land.
We're speaking with Russell Dibo in Ottawa, Canada. Russell is the founder of Defenders of the Land, a network of Indigenous communities and activists that today staged a protest at the Canadian Parliament against the proposed First Nations Education Act. Russell, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. And I was wondering first if you could tell me about the First Nations Education Act and what its impacts would be for Indigenous people in Canada.
Well, the First Nations Education Act is the latest in a suite of legislation, federal legislation, to amend the Indian Act. And the Indian Act is a law in Canada that's been around since 1876. It's basically an antiquated, racist, colonial piece of legislation. But it applies to Indians and Indian lands in Canada. And this new law is going to continue the oversight of the minister to determine imposed national standards on schools. They've got descriptions of principals. It's basically taking the residential school system and modernizing it by continuing an assimilation process that's been in place for well over 100 years. But now they're going to be doing it through the use of, you know, regulations and funding. And if they're not satisfied that the standards are being implemented as Ottawa wants them to be implemented, then they have the option to put in the schools into third-party management, where they just basically take it out of the community's hands and put in their own administrators. So it's quite a colonial piece of legislation they're trying to pass now.
Russell, today is International Human Rights Day, and Friends of the Land has participated by staging a protest. I was wondering if you could describe today's protest, the group's demands, and the outcome of the event.
Well, we're basically demanding the abolition of this First Nations Education Act. And not only is it Human Rights Day, but it's the day that in South Africa they were celebrating the legacy and memorial of Nelson Mandela. And, you know, there's a lot of parallels to what's happened in South Africa and Canada. They came to study the reserve system in Canada to create the Bantustan system, the apartheid system in South Africa. And South Africa had a Department of Native Affairs. But there, through their struggle, you know, they were able to get rid of that apartheid system. Here, it's a little different for us because we're in a minority, as, you know, First Nations or Indigenous peoples in Canada. And we're not pushing for equal rights. We're pushing for recognition of our pre-existing rights. And this is where, you know, the government is basically violating them by passing unilaterally legislation affecting our lives and lands, you know, which will have an impact for some time to come.
And Russell, Defenders of the Land has been cooperating with Idle No More and some other campaigns for Indigenous sovereignty to organize some teach-ins about what's happening to Indigenous rights right now in Canada. I was hoping you could talk about these teach-ins and what you're hoping they might accomplish.
Well, actually, there's two parts. We're doing encouraging teach-ins to understand the system, the colonial system that's oppressing us, but also we're encouraging actions by people on the ground. And we've been supportive of things like the anti-fracking movement of the Mi'kmaq in Elsipuktu in New Brunswick, Barrier Lake, and blocking clear-cut logging in their territory and other groups across the country. So we're dealing with resource extraction. So, you know, part of it is an educational campaign, but part of it is also direct action on the ground to support the communities who are, you know, trying to have a say in what's going on in their territory.
And speaking of direct action, currently in Central Oregon near Pendleton, massive shipments of tar sands drilling equipment are being immobilized by a combination of extreme weather as well as direct action organizing by activists here in Oregon, in cooperation with First Nations tribes.
I've heard that.
I'm wondering if you have more comments on how we should see the fight against tar sands megaloads as connected to the fight against the First Nations Education Act.
Well, the connection is, you know, it goes back to the lands and resources that haven't been addressed. I know in Canada, you know, that's the thing, is we don't have a say in the management of them and we're not benefiting from them. You know, they basically have stolen those lands and resources and haven't resolved, you know, how they're going to redistribute them or, you know, address our role in managing them. The tar sands itself is a huge impact. And I think with the pipelines they're proposing coming out of there to ship that into different directions, we need greater coordination, I think, between Native American tribes in the U.S. and First Nations in Canada.
to, you know, have a better, more effective campaign.
Russell Dibo, founder of Ottawa-based Defenders of the Land. Russell, thanks once again for joining me, and we'll be watching your fights closely in the coming days and months. And thank you.
Thank you.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Trade representatives failed to reach an agreement in Singapore on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement as labor, environmental, and congressional critics blasted the TPP as an American jobs killer. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard.
Before you look at this deal, you got to look at all the previous deals and say which one of the trade deals that we've done has resulted in net job gains and net trade surplus for America. And you know what the answer is? None. We're not against trade in the Steelworkers Union. We're against trade that continues to cost us jobs. The Steelworkers Union is aggressively opposed to the kind of trade deals we've been negotiating and would like to be part of a trade deal that actually created net jobs in America.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa urges Congress to oppose the TPP and fast-track authority to pass it.
They've all been losers for America. American jobs are being basically exported. That's what's going on. Everybody knows it. And for people to put their heads in the sand and say, oh, trade agreements are good, they're not playing with the truth. They're not looking at what the facts are. And it's time for us to basically stand up. And the first fight is going to be over fast track. I urge members of Congress to stand up, say no fast track. We want transparency. And until you do that, it ain't going to happen.
Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says manufacturing is not the only major jobs hit that American workers are taking from these NAFTA-style trade agreements.
We've been losing service sector jobs at the same pace as manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. As Leo said, we need to look at net results, net exports minus imports, and net results on jobs. The 600 multinationals that are promoting this, including many from the service sector, they're looking at their net profit. We need to look at net jobs.
U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter vehemently opposes both the TPP and Fast Track.
Fast Track Authority is an undemocratic seizure of power that usurps our ability to represent the American people. I have never seen a single trade agreement that benefited American workers or American producers. And the flawed free trade agreements like NAFTA have destroyed American manufacturers and American jobs for more than 20 years, and we have to stop that from happening again.
Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruin shares the deep concerns of labor and some members of Congress over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Sierra Club is deeply concerned about the effect of this PAC on working families in America, communities, our environment, and our climate. As trade expands, so does the potential for illegal trade in natural resources, such as trees and even wildlife parts, such as rhino horn or shark fin. To prevent these harmful practices, the Sierra Club and our 2.1 million members and supporters are calling for a strong and binding environment chapter of the TPP.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai spoke out today against the United States, accusing it of acting like a colonial power in its attempts to force the Afghan president to sign a bilateral security agreement by the end of the year. Washington and NATO officials say the pact is critical to the plan to keep thousands of forces in Afghanistan after 2014 for a training and counterterrorism mission. U.S.-backed talks between Afghanistan and Taliban failed in June of this year. Protests continue at the Afghan-Pakistan border to block the shipment of U.S.-made drones across the border.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Don Merrill, Kelly Connor Sunrose, and Sam Smith. The producer and engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Smith.
And I'm Nat Parker. Coming up on tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Lisa Loving speaks with Carrie McClellan, Pacific Northwest Executive Director of Operation Homefront, which supports military families living in poverty. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Cenk Soderbergh interviews Eva Bartlett about the reality of life in Gaza, including the dangers posed to fishers, farmers, and anyone in the border regions. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, it's the second annual beekeeping edition. Host Glenn Anderson and guest Jim Gilbert welcome Portland Urban Beekeepers President Tim Wessels to talk about beekeeping in the city. They'll also discuss the aftermath of the Arctic cold blast and how to evaluate your plant's health. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, stay tuned for a live interview by KBOO's Linda Olsen Osterlund with a member of Code Pink on today's rally about the deportation of Guantanamo detainees.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to the KBOO News in Depth. I'm Linda Olsen Osterlund. Today is International Human Rights Day, and in Washington, D.C., the day was marked by an emergency protest at the Algerian embassy called for by the Center for Constitutional Rights, Witness Against Torture, and Code Pink. To talk about that action and why it was called is Noormir, Code Pink organizer. Welcome to KBOO, Noormir.
Thanks for having me.
Really glad to have you here with us. Can you tell us what precipitated this emergency action?
Well, there was a call for this action by the Center for Constitutional Rights last week. They found out that one of their clients, for whom they've been advocating for several years at this point, was repatriated forcibly to Algeria against his will after having been pardoned under both President Bush and President Obama's presidency, so it came as a shock to everyone. And he had said that one thing he feared just as much, if not more, than being detained at Guantanamo was being secretly detained in Algeria, which is his current case right now. So understandably, his attorneys are very worried about him.
His name is... Can you tell us his name?
His name is Jamel, D-J-A-M-E-L, Amezian.
Amezian. I'm glad. I wanted you to pronounce it because I was sure I would be doing a bad job of it. My understanding is that he originally left Algeria when the civil war was going on. He's a Berber and not on the winning side of that war, and has feared return. Is that accurate?
Yes. So he's ethnically, his origin is a Berber. And as you know, during the civil war, Berbers were persecuted beyond belief. And that's when he did end up relocating to Austria, where he was a chef. After that, his stay in Austria ran out, and he was in Canada, where he was trying to gain residency and where he actually had some family members. And after that, he was forced to seek shelter in Afghanistan. And then once again, he seems to be on the receiving end of a lot of violence, because when the war in Afghanistan broke out, he had to try and escape, and that's when the bounty hunters that are infamous in Pakistan and with the intelligence in Pakistan and the U.S. during the war ended up finding him and using him as bait and to get money, and ended up sending him to Guantanamo, where he has been since February 2002.
February 2002 is a very long time ago. And my understanding, as you said earlier, is that he has been cleared for release, but instead his attorneys had no foreknowledge of his repatriation to Algeria. Is that accurate?
Yep. They had absolutely no reason to believe that he would be going back to Algeria. In fact, you know what, the most interesting fact is that he had already been offered asylum from countries neighboring Austria. For instance, Luxembourg had actually offered him asylum. So it actually makes no sense as to why the United States would not take up the offer from a country where John Mill actually wanted to go and instead repatriated him to the place where he least wanted to be.
And during his time at Guantanamo, was he one of the members that was participating in the hunger strike?
That's something that I was actually looking into, but they don't have his name as one of those folks, but he has been in solitary confinement a number of times and has also suffered various abuses.
And so at this time, we know he was taken to Algeria. Do we know what's happened to him in Algeria?
Absolutely nothing. We just know that he is in solitary detention. And, you know, with the history of the United States connections with various secret detention centers and black sites all over the world, we can only imagine what he's going through right now.
And this is not, you know, many people were hoping for more people to be taken out of Guantanamo. This was not the way that people meant it to be and does not seem consistent with what people thought would happen once people were beginning to be returned.
Absolutely not. The thing is that there's such a push to have people actually be, you know, relocated from Guantanamo, but little accountability for where they're going to be. So oftentimes what we have seen is that a lot of folks that do end up getting relocated end up going to black sites and secret detention centers that are just as bad, if not worse, than Guantanamo. And in some of these cases, you never hear from these folks again. So, you know, Guantanamo is just one of a handful of detention centers, and there are many, many more black sites where you never hear from some of these people ever again. So that's the problem, is that, you know, we might have a statement saying, well, these many people have been relocated, but do we know where they're going? Probably not.
So can you tell us about the actual activity today? How many people showed up? I know the weather was not good. And what were you asking of the embassy staff?
So we were there for, there were 15 people, which is a lot more than I expected, and we were at the Algerian embassy, and we delivered a letter, which is similar to what they delivered at the Algerian consulate in New York on Friday, asking His Excellency Ambassador Abdullah Bali to protect the human rights of Jamal and to release him immediately, and calling attention to the fact that this was in violation of international law, that he had already been pardoned, and we also told him to right Obama's wrong, and that the fact that Obama had already been, you know, a part of Jamal's horrible time in Guantanamo didn't mean that the Algerian government had to also extend the same kind of injustice. So that's basically what we were calling for. We went to the door of the Algerian embassy and delivered the letter. Somebody received it and said that they would deliver it to his boss, who I'm assuming is either the ambassador or somebody underneath him. And I'm going to be calling tomorrow to make sure that it was delivered to the right hands.
And this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KABU In Depth. I'm speaking with Noor Mir of Code Pink about a rally and organized activity today at the Algerian embassy. Today is International Human Rights Day. It was my understanding that two men were taken out of Guantanamo for Algeria. Is that right?
Yeah, so the rumor is that one of them was, in fact, a relative of his, but I have a little knowledge of what that's about.
So we don't have an attorney who's come forward or anyone who's talking about that second person?
No. All we know is that it was somebody who Jamal knew, and it was also somebody, an Algerian. That's all we know.
All right. So they make it difficult to get information from what's going on in Gitmo. I do understand that earlier this week or late last week, Gitmo announced that it would not be giving the regular updates about hunger strikers. Is that something that you have also been aware of?
Yeah, I heard about that, and, you know, that's a little concerning. But, you know, now we have all this debate going on about the NDAA, and from what I understand, just yesterday, they might have loosened restrictions on the repatriation of detainees, so it might be that we're seeing more movement of detainees between countries.
And this is in response to what act? What were you saying about the NDAA?
So from what I understand is that there has been some debate about the NDAA now, and in particular its causes related to Guantanamo. And from what I understand, what they're looking towards now is actually loosening the restrictions on movement from detainees from Guantanamo to their countries of origin. So we might be seeing a lot more of this movement between former Guantanamo detainees and their countries of origin. That might be something we're seeing in the future. Though what's specific about John Wolf's case is that he was escaping Algeria, and he was in fact an asylum seeker. For them to send him back to Algeria is actually completely against his wishes and against his will, as opposed to what might be the case with other detainees.
Well, I do believe there are other detainees, however, who don't want to be returned to their country of origin, including some Uyghur detainees who still remain. And this action on the part of the Obama administration is concerning. We would want them to be not loosening up the restrictions so that they can send people back to places where they will be harmed. Are attorneys concerned that this is the direction that they plan on going with as they empty out Guantanamo?
Absolutely. I think that more and more attorneys, and, you know, we have folks from the ACLU, folks from CCR, that represent a lot of these folks that are in Guantanamo, and hopefully what we'll see is more attention and more of a light that is shown on these folks that actually have a say in where they want to go. And a lot of the times the people that do end up in Guantanamo are asylum seekers because they're escaping from various sites of violence where they have been persecuted by the state and end up in precarious situations where they're then caught into and taken to Guantanamo. So hopefully, you know, attorneys will be talking about what these detainees want, not what the state wants out of it. And that's all we can hope for, is that their rights are respected, because who knows what will happen to them when they go back to a state where they were originally persecuted for reasons unknown.
And this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for the KABU News In Depth, and I've been speaking with Noor Mir, organizer for Code Pink and an organizer at the rally today at the Algerian Embassy. I know that if people go to ccrjustice.org, they can sign petitions and find out how to take action and support Dajamil. Is that also true with the Code Pink site?
Absolutely. Go on Code Pink and look for our Guantanamo page. And in addition to that, if we have any updates about Jamal's case, we'll be posting them there. And I really urge everyone to call the Algerian embassy and just ask them what the status is on Jamal, ask them if they have any information about what's happening, and tell them that it's a grave violation of international law and that they really need to respect this man's basic rights.
All right, and thank you so much for talking with KABU News.
Thank you for having me.
KABU is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KABU's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KABU jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m., on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Finally, the housing market is recovering. Sales and prices are up. But wait, home ownership is still going down. That's right. The banksters are at it again. This time, they've bought up 200,000 foreclosed homes, bundled them to sell as rental-backed securities. A new financial instrument is born, creating a new housing bubble. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, on a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. My guest is Laura Gottsdiener, author of How Wall Street Has Turned Housing into a Dangerous Get-Rich-Quick Scheme Again. That's this Thursday at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com. This KBOO program is...
You're listening to 90.7 FM KBOO Out Loud Radio. I'm Natalie Marie, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Radio Cab Turkey Project, a hunger relief program providing complete Christmas dinners to families struggling with food insecurity, seniors, the infirm, and those without transportation. Information on how to make donations at radiocabfoundation.org. Once again, I'm Natalie Marie. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Out Loud. Again, joining me in the studio today is Dexter Flowers, the wonderful Dexter. Say hi, Dexter.
Hi.
Back again to make some more wonderful queer radio tonight. We've got a great show lined up. We're going to hear from some new radio makers in Portland. You've been teased before, but now we'll get the full story, speaking with Thomas from Wild Planet Radio.